what Brooklyn sounds like.
Downloads of this show are available on Podomatic.com and the Podomatic mobile app.
Hey, it's time for Dr. Lisa Gives a Shit. And I'm Dr. Lisa. I give a shit. We all need somebody who really cares about us. And, you know, I'm sending my caring thoughts and feelings out to you. We should all be, I think people are starting to like feel uplifted in the last day or two, because I did notice, and it's not just you, but I noticed this sort of wholesale depression visiting everyone, because it just, the winter was dragging on. It's that winter residue that, you know, we're all kind of tired of. And I think that happens sort of like every season, like the end of the summer, we're all like, I don't know, maybe it's not really kind of the same. The end of the winter is a lot more fun. But anyway, we're all in a good mood today because it's really nice out. And, you know, Michael Cohen's got his jail sentence. Roger Stone's getting his jail sentence. So I think we're all feeling a little more hope. I don't know. That cheers me up. Is that mean? I can be mean. I care about people, but I can also be mean. Those are two things I can have. So I can have both those qualities. I want to remind you that you're listening to Radio Free Brooklyn. Dr. Lisa Gives a Shit in particular. I'm here every Thursday, 2 to 3. And please join us. Please, you know, we're doing this really great teen program for teens. We're teaching them all about radio and media literacy, and we could use a few. You know, join in and help us. Go to radiofreebrooklyn.org/donate. So I have a particularly fascinating guest for you today. Her name is Rebecca. I'm going to start with that. Okay, so I want Rebecca to tell you about herself mostly. But I'm going to give you a little background. One thing I would like to let you know is that her artwork is fabulous. Her work is beautiful, poignant, well-made, but thoughtful, and has an intellectual, you know, it draws you in. And I think you can get a lot out of it by looking at it for a long time. And I like work like that. I think it's meaningful. So she has shown a lot. She has a master's degree in art, and she's studying art history at Hunter. And I can tell you all those things about her. And Rebecca is also, like, we are going to be starting a show here with her soon, a podcast, which she'll tell you about. And she's had a really fascinating journey from to America. She grew up around with the squat theater community. The squat theater community is... I was immediately excited about that because the squat theater, when I moved to New York in 1978, was this very, very well-known, very avant-garde theater organization or whatever, and community, you know, co-op organization, whatever you want to call it. And they did very radical and very, I think, important work. I know that they must be in a lot of history books about New York and history of theater and stuff like that. So she, Rebecca, was on the first lines as a child in that environment. So I think I'm certain we are going to have a fascinating conversation, and let's get to it. So the first thing we're going to do is have Rebecca introduce herself and explain what she wants to about her childhood and coming to America.
Hi, Rebecca. Hello, Dr. Lisa.
Please talk into the mic.
Oh, yeah. So, where should I start? On the coming to Ellis Island and No, I'm just joking. I didn't go through Ellis Island, but I was...
You were born in...
I was born in Budapest, and...
Are you an only child?
No, I have an older sister.
Uh-huh. Is so, she in America, too?
Yeah, we came here together with my mother when we were... I was five. Well, I was six, actually. I left Hungary at the age of five, but by the time I arrived in the United States, I was six. We spent a year in Paris, and my sister is 5 years older.
And she was with you?
Yeah.
So three of you?
Yeah. Well, three of immediate family, and then this adoptive, you know, collective family, which was the Squat Theater, members of the mm-hmm. Squat Theater. And there were other children there already.
So what did, but so you were moving from Budapest to join them eventually?
Well,
I mean, did they already exist?
Interesting. We left in small groups of people. It wasn't that everybody was able to get on the same plane and leave Budapest at the same time, right, but we all met up in Paris.
But so, the question I'm asking is, was the Squat Theater formed in Hungary?
Yes, it was formed.
And you moved as a collective.
Several years prior. Okay. In fact, the name Squat Theater was only adopted once they left Hungary. Mm-hmm. It was a different name. It was a Hungarian mm-hmm. name called Apartment Theater.
Right.
So, as the equivalent, you know, the translation.
So it was a group. And your mother, I'm assuming, was a theater person then?
She was not. She studied graphic design at the National Academy.
Mm.
I mean, that was technically the term of what she studied, but it was a fine arts academy. Mm-hmm. And that's where she had met my husband.
Brian Slip
there. Uh-huh. Ooh, okay, what are you going to do with that one? Her future husband, which was my father, at school, which is such a traditional story of like, ooh, cell phones going off.
Oh, that never happens.
Is that a theme song?
That rarely happens. No, sorry about that.
Oh, it's fine.
It's my cousin Jamie. Hi, Jamie.
They were together for 10 years. My mother did leave him in a not so nice way. She had started an affair with one of the members of the Squat Theater, mm-hmm. and that's how she became a theater person.
Mm.
And then, my father, you know, we were talking a little bit earlier about the immediate circumstances surrounding my departure or our departure. And I don't know the exact story, but I believe my father had a nervous breakdown mm-hmm. right around that time. So he was incapacitated from really doing anything about it. Mm. But I also feel that he was the type of person that would just have allowed things to happen, even mm-hmm. though...
You remember him as passive.
He was... kind of passive. Mm-hmm. It doesn't mean that he didn't care. I don't think he knew really, like, my mother was a very strong
Your mother was
willed
a force
individual.
In nature. Yes.
Yeah, she was a force in nature.
So let me just ask you one question. So your older sister, is she in this country now?
Yes, she is.
Where does she live?
She lives in New York City.
And are you guys close? Do you talk about what happened?
Well, you know,
do you get information about your childhood from her?
We should, yeah, she and I should talk about it more. In fact, I'm not so much in contact with any members of my family. Mm-hmm. I think the reason for that is because it was, you know, a good, it was very interesting and there were lots of wonderful things, but it was also a lot of dark and difficult things. And I think that when that happens, people in later in life, they just, you know, need space or something. And I think that that's what we both need. But we do kind of come together every once mm-hmm. in a while. And
Are you and her hesitant about talking about it?
Not entirely. No,
but
I mean, think so. I don't think that's...
Is it uncomfortable?
I don't think that topic is particularly taboo for us. In fact, uh-huh. She and I are attempting to work together on being... what is the word? Caretakers of our father's mm-hmm.
Estate
because mm-hmm. he was an artist and mm-hmm. he We inherited jointly a number of artworks, mostly, you know, works on paper, because that's mm-hmm. what was his medium, which is really great to do that, to inherit works mm-hmm. on paper, because they're easy to handle. Right. It's not like sculpture or something.
What does your sister do?
I'm not sure.
How is it that you're not sure?
It's like, I don't know what she does. I think she's like independently unwealthy. I don't know. I mean, she owns an apartment, which was gifted to her by our mother. I think she rents out.
You're not really in touch with her. And what about your dad? I mean, your mom. I'm sorry. That's important.
My mother had a career for many years with the Squat Theater as the sole artistic director, which meant that she did everything from designing to producing all the sets and techniques. And she actually won an Obie Award for it in the 80s. That's very impressive.
Especially, there was so much great theater in New York then. I mean, that's really impressive. It was like I was telling you guys, it was a very, very well-respected theater. I'm not surprised to hear that.
And then she worked for, I don't know if you know Richard Haas, but he was a muralist and had a big company. She worked for him for a number of years. Mm-hmm. And then she became an independent decorative painter. Mm-hmm. And that is what she still does on occasion. Yeah. But she's like semi-retired.
Do you see her very often? Where does she live?
No, I don't. I mean, we communicate sometimes and like we have moments of truce, but for the most part, we're not mm-hmm. in contact. Mm-hmm. She lives in New York too.
Mm-hmm. So I just wanted to make sure there's one really famous play,
It was Andy Warhol's Last Love. There was Pink Child Fire, which was also mm-hmm. put the Squat mm-hmm. Theater on the map. It mm-hmm. toured Europe. Mm-hmm. We even went to Iran once.
Wow, as a child. So do you remember what life was like for you in those? Do you remember moving here? Do you remember going through all that?
I remember little bits and pieces, trying to adjust. Some of it was trying to adjust with like the food mm-hmm. because I didn't like peanut butter and jelly. I just did not understand that. Like, what are you guys eating? What is that? It's so saccharine. It's so sweet.
Yeah, I know. I get it.
That type of thing. Little things like that.
Peanut butter and jelly doesn't really make sense if you think about it, you know?
No, but I mean, those two individually are great. And I like it now, too. It's just that the sweetness, everything was sweeter and the portions mm-hmm. were bigger. And I'm sure a lot of people say that when they come to this country, but I'm here to testify that it is true. Mm-hmm. Like I would go to my friends' homes and they'd have this huge meal. And then you're like, okay, that was really hard to get through. It was great. It was delicious. But I think I need to like fall asleep or something and mm-hmm. digest. And then there'd come this massive, portion of pie with this massive dollop of vanilla ice cream on top. And you're mm-hmm. like, how can you eat that after that huge meal?
Welcome to America. So what is your impression of like those times? Because I imagine like from my point of view, they sound like they would be really stressful and unpredictable and all that, like not knowing, you know, being brought to, you know, first you were in Paris and then some other place and all that. Like, that sounds really disorienting and frightening. Do you remember how you felt? Did your mom make you feel secure or was it weird? Or do you remember how you felt?
Oh, I don't remember any particular incidences of panic. Although I got lost in the subway. I think I had reoccurring nightmares for a long time after that.
How old are you?
It happened twice, I think, and I was around 7.
Did you get away from you weren't riding the subway alone, were you?
Yeah, I was.
At 7?
Yeah, like, it's like that nightmare where, like, your family gets off and you are slow, you're lagging behind and the doors close. It happened to me. That was not so bad, but then it happened again where I went to school by myself.
At age
7, my mom put me on the subway, she didn't wait for the subway for me. And I got on the wrong subway. And then I found myself all the way uptown and lost in New York City. Like, that's a nightmare.
Well, I mean, I know this sounds really judgmental, but...
But why did she let me on the subway
from my point of view, that seems really, like, yeah, irresponsible. And what's your... But I'm... That's me.
I think
what's your feeling about it?
I also think that is crazy. Like, I would never do that. But I was very independent. I mean, I did a lot of things by myself, I think. I don't know. That was a strange once in a... Mm-hmm. It just didn't... I don't know why she did that.
That was outstanding. But what she... So what I'm trying to find out is if you felt safe, if she made you feel safe, or if you were more trying to... If you were put in a position of looking out for yourself,
I think... Well, she was, like I said, a strong individual, and... I think that as long as I was nearby, like, I felt safe, you know. But it's really funny because I had a best friend who grew up on my block, and her mom had a second child without, like, a parent and, you know, a husband or boyfriend in the house. So my friend ended up being, how do you say, like, the second caretaker. And since I was her best friend, I would also be like a second caretaker. And we were 10 years old. So from the age of 10 till about 17, every day after school, we would take her little sister to the sand park, to wherever. So the three of us, me and my friend and her little sister, were like very independent. And
were you all part of the squat theater family?
No, she lived down the block. She was not a theater member, but she was like practically a theater member.
And where were you living?
23rd Street between 7th and 8th Avenues.
Right, right. And was that, that's the location of the theater as I remember. So
yeah.
Did you live in where the theater was?
Yeah.
So what was living there like? Was it like a big commune, or what was it like?
Yeah, it was a big commune, exactly. So there was a communal kitchen on the second floor, and then there were two floors above that where the members would have their apartments, and there were like two or three apartments on each. And when I mean apartment, it was just there was a communal bathroom and like a living room area for themselves and bedroom. There's no like private kitchen. So all the cooking and eating was done together.
And what school did you go to?
I went to a school nearby called IS-70, which incidentally was funny because the year before I arrived, they had been voted by the city as number one in like English and literature. But it was one of the, in my opinion, talk about coming to America was so dangerous. Like, there were dropout kids selling, you know, crack, not crack. It was like a precursor to crack.
Yeah.
It was like, but
drugs,
speed. And all this stuff. Like, these were kids that dropped out in the seventh grade selling drugs. And there would be huge fights where the police would have to come and intervene after school.
Wow.
Like, imagine hundreds of kids. And then I remember once like seeing tufts of hair like on the street and kids would get mugged in the hallways on their way to getting a drink of water. And this was
in the
school that was a good school.
Wow.
Yeah.
So it sounds like your environment sounds, you know, really, let's say offbeat. We'll use that word. Did you feel that you were in a particularly different situation from other kids, or did you not really think about it when you were in school?
I think that sometimes I got these, awakenings where people were like, oh, that's interesting. I remember one time a friend's dad picked her up from coming, she was at my
playing
house playing
at your house.
Play date or whatever. And I think I was like in the fourth grade or something. And he comes into my bedroom, which I shared with my adoptive theater sister. But he was like, his jaw dropped. He's like, do you realize your bedroom is the same size as our entire apartment?
Like, you had a big bedroom?
Yeah. It was like 700 square feet.
Wow.
Yeah, it was huge. And I shared that with my sister before she moved out. And
how did you get so much room?
And an adoptive stepsister. So really it was just like the three of us in this massive room because it was a huge building. It was like a
own the building.
It was like a double wide townhouse.
Mm-hmm.
So double wide, like imagine, like mm-hmm. it's not.
I'm trying to remember it. I mean, I know I've been there.
I mean, it was, yeah. So for us, so I think we were like 16 people all together, including children. It was a big, we had a lot of space. In fact, one of the ironies of like living in a place or growing up the way I did was that I felt really wealthy in this, in certain ways, and very poverty stricken in other ways. In other words, the space was grand. I had this beautiful bedroom with a skylight in the center of it. But yet we had no hot water or no heat. And if you missed dinner, there was nothing to eat except maybe some bread and butter.
Wow.
So it was like this strange. And then the other thing that we would have, which other, you know, friends of mine didn't have, were these, we would be invited every other summer to festivals in Europe.
Right.
So we were treated like kings.
Oh, wow.
You know, so.
And you were always in a group,
it was a mix,
right?
It was a big mix.
Did you feel like that group was your family more than just your parents, mother, meaning?
Yeah,
mother and sister, really.
Yeah, of course.
That might have given you a feeling of being insulated in a way.
Insulated when we traveled?
Well, it sounds like the whole thing was just this, to me, being from a fairly, you know, my background is so much more conventional. Your background sounds, you know, a little out of control in the sense that there's just a lot, it sounds like a lot of people and taking this, you know, like your mother sounds like, she gave you a lot of freedom. And so I'm just saying, but kind of like if you had a problem, there were probably like five different adults.
No, I would never go to any of them with any of my problems.
Why?
Because they were so nuts. You know,
so
like adults to me, like it wasn't that type.
What was their behavior?
But
like?
I think that I did feel comfortable with them to a certain degree. I mean, there were certain members of the theater that always felt more of a mystery to me than others. Mm-hmm. And I think that I was wary of adults in general, to be quite honest. And I think that I was a bit shy and like a little bit reluctant to engage. And I really got more of my sense of camaraderie or from friends. And I also spent quite a bit of time outside of the home. So through my friends and their families, I would spend time with them. And I think that in retrospect, it was a decision, although it was a subconscious or unconscious decision I was making. But I really felt like I needed to have other influences.
Right.
I felt like. Because
stability.
I think the adults in the theater kind of thought in a way that they were living this rock and roll life, you know, like they might have.
Did you see a lot going on? Was there not drugs and sex and craziness, or what did you see?
I actually witnessed things, but there was a lot of pot smoking. There was a ton of cigarette smoking. There was, I mean, my home was a nightclub for many years. Like I would hear the music and, but I don't think I necessarily witnessed anything particularly, but I just felt like I don't think that I got that sense that they would really have time for kids' problems anyway.
Right. Right.
So I probably just didn't even
bother. Now your
mother
was the artistic director. So was she sort of like, you know, in charge of all this in any way, or
in charge of the artistic,
the whole community in any way?
Well, there were a lot of decisions that were made communally. Like they would have these round table talk discussions about various things, mostly about creative things like writing a new play, et cetera. Yeah. And I was also an actress, I guess you'd say.
Were you in the production?
I was in several of them, but a lot of the roles were quite, you know, easy for a child to do. Like the first instance of me performing all of the children were asked to perform, and it was in a production called Cool King Kong, which premiered in Amsterdam in an old decommissioned church.
Wow.
And it was actually a really fun role. Like, I was asked to put on a silver trench coat and silver spray painted boots, and the boots had these little like star stamps on the heel, and I was asked to like just walk down the aisle of the nave of the church with the other children, you know, in a single line, and somehow we were like supposed to be aliens from another planet.
That sounds like fun.
And but the best part was that the entire theater was blaring the Bee Gees, like one of their hit songs, and it was like this moment of recognition for me that I actually really love disco.
You know, it's really funny. It's such a joyous look on your face when you were discussing that. I just want my listeners to know that it was hilarious. So I've never heard anybody talk about the Bee Gees quite that reverentially. But anyway, thank you for that. So how does one go from an environment like that to go to like college and Hunter College? Like, you know what I mean? Like how did you transition into adulthood? And like, did you live in that way until you went to college, or like what happened there?
Well, I went to Pratt Institute. I went to an arts high school. So I guess it was very seamless for me
in New
like
York,
doing like, art. Yeah. And
art and design, high school art and design.
LaGuardia is.
You went to LaGuardia.
Yeah, LaGuardia.
That makes sense. Which is the fame school.
Right, it's the fame school.
So you were around like a bunch of actors and actresses.
Yeah.
Did you meet, you know, they have celebrity kids there. Did you meet any celebrity kids?
No. I think there were a couple of celebrities in the school at the time. I think Jennifer Aniston was maybe a few years ahead of me, and Cher's daughter was also, but it was a huge school, and there I
did but anyways,
not.
So
but that my friend actually was very close to getting the part against what's her name, you know, remember that film Dangerous Liaisons?
Yeah,
she was like, she was a very close contender for that
role. What's her name?
Uma Thurman's role.
Yeah, really?
Yeah,
wow.
So she was a working actor, and but she was not. She wasn't.
Yeah,
as famous, but clearly. But yeah,
that's a pretty good. That's a pretty good callback to.
Yeah, that's a pretty good callback. And I studied
when you got to high school, did that make you? Was that like a good transition? Do you feel at home there when you were finally around art kids? Like, did that feel?
I think
more
it felt
like
really natural for me. I don't think it felt, you know, like, oh, I found my people. It was just like, this is normal. Like, I remember thinking, this is how
but
naive
did it
I
seem
was.
More normal than a regular high school? No,
no, I think because I didn't go to a regular high school, so.
That wasn't just a normal high school that you went to? I mean, school?
It was in that sense, except that you had art classes, you had live nude drawing. You had to be a little
in high
bit.
School. It was advanced. It was a Manhattan high school, public school with a lot of kids.
It was like junior college in that sense that you were already, you know, doing the things that you envision yourself doing in the future. I guess.
Yeah. So it all kind of made sense when you were going through it.
But, you know, it's one of those things that I think in the back of my mind throughout my high school years and my college years, and I'm sure a lot of people have the same experience, but I think buried underneath I had anxiety about what the heck was I going to do when I got out, because being an artist is such an insecure future financially that. And it was always this, you know, anxiety that I kept suppressing, like, oh, you don't have to deal with it now, deal with it when you graduate. But, yeah. So, you know what I'm talking about?
Well,
anxiety?
Yeah, I guess so. No, I mean, yeah. I mean, it was something I studied commercial art for that particular reason, but.
Yeah. And I wish I would have, like, I wish I would have done something more, whatever, but I didn't. So I studied painting in college. And then my last year, I got really into photography, and that kind of took over for a number of years. I did photography. Mm-hmm. And at the time, Pratt Institute had this wonderful alumni program that allowed alumni to come back. It was like written in their charter. No other school did this. It was very, since then they've got done away with it. But any alumni that knew about this program, which was a small percentage of us, can come back and like use their facilities for a nominal fee. So it really allowed me as a, you know, struggling artist to make a huge, you know, body of work in photography. Right. They had the professional color printers and
that you took advantage of all that too.
Digital labs and everything. Yeah, it was great. And then after that, I got into video for a number of years because I felt like video is kind of an extension of photography. It felt like a very seamless.
And also theater.
Yes, and theater. And so ultimately, yeah, all of that body of work was influenced by my theater experiences and role playing. It was a lot of characters in my photography. It wasn't.
Did you live at the squat theater commune, let's call it, while you were going to college, or how did you?
No,
did you transition out of that?
The theater at the space on 23rd Street ended in the, can't remember the exact year, but again, mid-80s, late 80s. And then I moved into a relatively like nuclear family type situation, living situation with my stepfather and my mother and my dog, whom I loved.
Your older
Shout
sister.
Out to my childhood dog,
Yogi.
My sister at that point had already moved out many years prior. And at that, I think she was living in Paris. She moved to Paris. So glamorous, living very bohemian style. She, was studying at the Sorbonne, actually, art history, but she never, she didn't finish.
She's obviously bright.
Yeah, she's a bright girl.
Bright family.
And it's interesting because she never finished high school. Both she and my other stepsister, I don't know where they got this idea, because the same year, they're exactly the same age. They both dropped out in the 10th grade. I mean, this was back in the 80s when there's a lot of hard partying going on, and it was just not cool to be in school, because how are you going to stay out till 4 a.m. and make it to your next class and 8 a.m. or whatever? So it just was inconvenient for them.
Did you do that as well?
No.
No? She's looking at me like, no. Did they do that?
I mean, I went out, but...
Did you avoid all that, like, you know, partying and stuff?
No. No, but I don't think I took it quite as seriously, like as a job. Yeah.
They must have had some hell of a time there, huh?
Yeah.
Studio 54, maybe? Or was it more downtown than
that? I think it was, I mean, I'm sure they went that way, but.
More Mud Club.
Yeah. Oh, definitely the Mud Club, which I missed. I missed that whole thing.
You're too young.
But.
So what about your stepfather? Was that like having a real father
I mean,
role?
I think
Did you like him?
He influenced me the same amount that a real father would, but I'm not sure that was a good thing. I'm just joking.
Are you still in touch with him?
No, he passed away like 14 years ago.
Oh. Is he still in touch with your mom? I mean, was your mom still with him?
No,
they were separated.
He had moved back actually to Budapest and had started a new life really there. He had a second child who's like now maybe 17 or 15. Like he had a completely new chapter after the squat theater and after he and my mother's marriage dissolved. And I think I was already an adult.
So I've met you. I want to ask you a question. So I've met you several times, which I've always enjoyed immensely. But I would say that, like, after talking to you now, like, you present as not somebody from that background at all. Like, it's not superficially or even moderately superficially evident that you're from a background that you're describing, which is unusual from my point of view. So I'm wondering, like, what you've dealt with. I mean, you've said you've been in therapy. Like, how did it affect you? How did having a background like that affect you? Affect you today? Affect you at, you know, like, how have you gone through it?
I think it's just kind of, if anything, it's like confusing. So it's like being on a being spun around. You know, you put your someone puts blinders on you and spins you around and then takes off the blinders and be like, okay, do something good or try to keep your balance. That's mm-hmm. that's kind of a good analogy. Like, I think it was a little disorienting. Mm-hmm. I'm still intact and I'm fine.
Highly functional.
But I think that I had to, like, get my balance that experience.
Did you like, at some point realize that, I mean, I think to me what sounds the most difficult is that there seems to be a certain amount of inconsistency, that it would be hard for a child or developing human to count on, like, you know, a certain thing happening every day and, like, a certain person who's going to be in this room, you know, be home and like consistency and expectations. And,
well, you know, the funny thing about that thing about consistency is that even if you didn't know who was going to be home, you knew someone would be home because it was a huge house full of lots of people. So I kind of like that, but yeah,
but I mean, like, you didn't have a point person. It sounds like you didn't have a point person. Like, most kids have a point person. Hopefully the mother.
I think my mother would have been the point person, but I do think that she was quite
busy. She was busy.
And if she wasn't busy, she would add on things to make her. I mean, and she was a bit of a workaholic.
Yeah. And because you were living in a communal environment with people that were kind of like family, but not really family, I could see how she wouldn't have to be thinking about whether you were, and you're obviously absolutely an independent kid.
Absolutely. Like, she wasn't the PTA mom. Like, so, she was not a PTA mom.
Yeah, she was. It doesn't sound like she was intimately, like most parents or a lot, or she was no helicopter parent, let's put it that way. But you know how kids are really, like, when it came time.
Yeah, but you know, it's funny because I said the word that I'm independent, or that I was, like, I said that. Uh-huh. But in fact, I felt very dependent on her because I didn't really feel like I had the tools to, like, deal with things by myself. So I would relegate a lot of, mm-hmm. you know,
like
things.
Who filled out your college application?
My mother.
Okay.
But yeah, like, all I didn't right. know how to do anything.
Okay, so she kinda did do that.
Yeah, she did that.
Stuff uh-huh. like that.
Yeah.
So what happened as you transitioned into a full-fledged adult? Did you, like, wake up and was it, like, all of a sudden, like, God, this was so weird? Or was it, like, or how did you process it? I mean, you said you went to therapy and stuff
yeah,
like
I went
that.
To
so
therapy.
What initiated
I think that
you
helped.
To,
I think that
what
helped.
Initiated your thinking, like, I'm going to therapy?
I how think old, that
like,
I
what
had.
Days, what age group?
Oh, I was already an adult, like
early 20s.
Yeah, no, maybe mid or late.
Okay.
I think I just had a real strong desire to talk about it, and I wasn't, you know, like, to talk about the little things and
you wanted
know,
to feel
losing
hurt.
Losing my father, because, like, losing my father was not something we ever talked about at home. In fact, we hardly ever said his name.
You mean the fact that your mom, like, broke up with him.
Yeah. So there were a number of years when I really had no communication with him. And it got to the point where I couldn't even recognize him on a photograph. So I was, like, blocking out things, like, which is what children do. They're very resilient. It's like, mm-hmm. move on. Like, mm-hmm. it's better for your mental health to not be, you know, if you have immediate children things to do, like, try to be happy. But those things come back. Mm-hmm. So
there was a point in your life, maybe at adolescence, when you start noticing boys or whatever, being an adolescent, you start thinking, you might have been thinking about your dad, or was it a mystery? How did you get in touch with him?
We did. We went to visit him when I was 10. At that
so
point,
your mother took you.
Something like that. No, she did not come to the trip herself, but we happened to be in Europe for a festival and me and my sister went. And I think it was arranged between him and his sister, whom he shared a house with. They had a large house. And at that point, he had moved into that house and had like an apartment quarters there. And so I think it was arranged by them that we would go. So me and my sister went back. I remember my mother saying that if she had gone back on that trip, she would be jailed. Which to me, I was like, interesting. What?
Was that frightening a little?
It was frightening, but now I realize like, anyway, yeah, she would have been jailed because she took us out of the country illegally. So she couldn't go back for a number of years.
So was there like a hole missing that you didn't know about your dad? Like, did that feel confusing or did it feel, how did it feel?
Yeah, it felt very confusing because I had to completely try to rebuild a relationship that had, you know, stopped at a certain point. So when we did come to this country, it was, you know, like I was dealing with someone passing away or close family member dying. And then it was like a resurrection of sorts. But in a sense, it was like I didn't recognize the person anymore. I didn't know who. And I think likewise, I think with him, too, it was a little like, who is this person? And for me, it was like meeting someone completely for the first time.
How did that feel? Was it, that sounds sad to me. That sounds really like sad because it sort of, I mean, I don't mean to be a downer, but it kind of points out your development as a child that like just you and that didn't happen together. Like it, like
well,
you'd already.
He and I were very close when I was up until the age of five. So I don't, you know, I don't want to say this, but like a parent, you know how like parents sometimes choose dote on one of the children. Like I was that kid.
Yeah, the favorite.
And yeah.
Like my brother. Yeah. Thanks, mom.
But so, and my sister was more my mom's favorite. So like, that's how that balance was.
Right.
So, and of course I'm not saying it was easier for my sister. In fact, in some ways it was harder. I don't know, but I think we were both very much affected, but I think maybe, I don't know. It's hard to compare these things.
Do you feel resentment to your mom for not explaining it to you or for not handling it more
yeah,
directly?
Yeah, of course.
Have you talked to her about that or?
Well, yeah, but I think she's so not about
not
to talk
matter.
About it. It's not, where that
it's
not conversation gonna not going to move forward.
No. Well, you do know. So how did therapy like is, like what help, what
well,
what
it's funny because when I would get to a therapist's office, like the second I sat down, I would just start yabbering. And then, I mean, by yabbering, I mean explaining eloquently, my life story. So, but I wouldn't give them a moment to speak. And at the end of the many months, and sometimes over a year, maybe, I would complain that they had nothing to say to me. And this was consistent with like all three of them that I went to. And I was like, why aren't they saying, it started to hit me that maybe I was talking too much and just literally they didn't have a moment to say anything. I'm not sure, it could also just have been
See, this is what I'm talking about. It was a defense. See, this is what I'm talking about. Yeah, for sure. I mean, that's my feeling. I have no formal training. I think that
maybe
that was like a defense of some sort, an emotional defense so that either you didn't have to look at it or they weren't going to shine. You didn't really want to.
I'll tell you what it is.
Okay, go ahead. Yeah, you would know better than me.
Okay, so what it was that oh my God, I totally lost my train of thought.
Defense? Talking a lot? Was it defense?
Take your time.
Don't worry about it. It happens. It happens to me sometimes, is really bad since it's my show.
No, I realize one of the things that came out from my childhood is that I have I freeze up when things are expected of me. Like I failed the driving part of my driver's test five times or four times. Like I can't function if it's like, okay, one, two, three, go.
What?
I just freeze up. Like, it's, and I think that comes from the theater. Must have, or some sort of, it's literally like some sort of anxiety.
Mean being on.
And that's probably why I couldn't remember my train of thought just now.
Interesting.
Yeah, probably.
Huh. You get overwhelmed a little.
Yeah, it's overwhelming.
Because being on because being on stage. Did that ever happen to you on stage?
Well, you know, some of the roles, like I mentioned, the childhood roles, were really seamless from life to stage.
Just pretending.
It was just like, well, there was another thing where children were asked to have supper. There's this thing in Europe called supper, which is not the same as dinner. It's just like a light fare before bedtime. Mm-hmm. So we had supper on stage with the other children. Like, it's a very simple task to do, right?
Right.
It's not, it doesn't require acting. But then when I was about 17, 18, I had an actual role. And the character's name was the same as me. So there's a little seamless thing there. But other than that, she really wasn't, you know.
You were playing another character. You're playing character.
And it was at BAM.
Wow.
And there were literally hundreds of people out in the audience, like a sea of people.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember being off wing or on the wing or whatever, and thinking the feeling that I'm having right now is the same equivalent of those people that have to jump off an airplane like just a whole body experience. Like, it's not even mental anymore. It's like your whole body is like freaking out. So that was a little traumatic, but I got over it. And once I got on stage, everything was fine. And you know,
good. Yeah, it, like, no, that's a big deal.
I even had fun with it.
Oh, good.
But it's just that anxiety.
A big deal. Yeah. To make that leap. Yeah, for
that
sure.
That leap.
So you managed that. That's good. So as far as we were talking, so defense, I was accusing you aggressively of using talking consistently as a defense. And you said, no, it wasn't. You said it was that you knew it was something else. And I think it was,
I can't remember exactly what I was going to say, but I think it was because I had not been heard and I never spoke about it. And I just wanted recognition. That's the word. That's what I was going to say. I wanted someone else
to validate and
validation.
Right.
And I think therapists are trained not to take sides. So they don't really do that thing that I was looking for. You know,
well, or they, I'm going to also say perhaps that, you were just, you didn't, cause I noticed even working, talking with you now, I'm asking you directly, how did this feel, like that corny shrink question? How did that make you feel? Because, I'm noticing that you're describing events in beautiful details, and you are leaving out your feelings about them, and they are extreme events that must have feelings. So I'm wondering if you were confusing the therapist by being aggressively talking, but not hinting that was what you were trying to convey, that you were trying to get validation, you know, because you sounds like you didn't get it.
I don't think I ever said, I want your validation, because that would be like cheating or something. Like,
no,
this is
no.
what I want, so give that to me. No, I would have just wanted it.
Okay, well, like,
to be given freely.
Suppose, like, I mean, I think I've been to a whole bunch of shrinks myself. So I imagine saying to a shrink, it was really, I really resent the fact that my mother didn't have my father call once a week. And then I imagine the shrink saying something like, yeah, that makes sense that you would feel that way. You didn't get that?
Not so much.
How that's validating, though?
Yeah.
That's validating without taking sides.
Right. No,
that's
it's
just
really
validating.
I think I just got unlucky in a sense that all of the therapists that I've had were relatively quiet. Like, they didn't really give much back.
Were they Freudian? Did you go like once a week or?
Oh my God. One of them was transference stuff.
Yeah. Transference.
And the other one, I don't know what the other two were. One of them was at the, do you know the Karen
Horny. Karen Horny.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Which is
yeah.
so embarrassing to say, like, I go to the Horny Clinic.
Yeah, right, right, right. Karen Horny's super famous. Anyway, could be a bunch of things. It could be that you were communicating that you just needed to talk. I could also see if I was a crappy shrink or a lazy shrink. You know, the person comes in, we get
lazy,
the weekend,
I think would be one.
And they just want to talk and talk and talk. And, you know, I don't know what it's like being a professional shrink where you really are getting paid and you have the pressure and you have eight patients a day. But, you know, if somebody's like talking and then you're just thinking, well, they need to like get all this out on the table, they could miss. And the way that you're presenting it, they might have missed that you needed that validation and you didn't. Mm-hmm. You didn't want to get it. There was something about you that you were resisting getting it because you
I was constantly talking.
Yeah, and I mean, if it was something that you know you some with, like you were you could have been overcompensating because you really wanted it. Like it might have been something you wanted so much.
Right. You know, it's funny that you mentioned that because I remember some of the times I got to the point where I was like, I feel like I'm entertaining these people. Like I'm just going on and on and on. Like, thank God this is, you know, it's a client, blah, 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 privilege, like confidential, because they could go off and just write a whole thing. Like I'm giving them a lot of material, mm-hmm. you know, and I got to the point where I'm like, am I doing this for them? Am I performing in the sense of like my theater? Like, I don't want to have them get bored. Not that I embellished anything.
Maybe there's some ego involved. Maybe you were really proud of your experience, which I can imagine. It was very special. And you handled it and you got a lot out of it. Maybe you were really proud of it. Maybe you didn't spoke about it like it was something you were proud of, and so that would have hidden.
I don't know if I did or not. I think that's an interesting question, but I don't think
that didn't sound right. Well, I don't know. I mean, it could, but that is a big. So are you in therapy now? Well, you
no,
are right this
I
minute
have, yeah this is an intense session. It is, though.
Is it? Oh, well, good. I'm glad we're thinking about things.
What was the question?
I was wondering if you'd been... It's interesting. Oh, we got you to shut down. See, you shut down. This is great. That's when you really get somewhere, when you shut down. That's great. I love it. So simple. So I'm wondering, like, if you have gotten what... Like, if therapy is... If you've gotten what you can out of therapy, if you're in therapy now, you're not. Did therapy help you?
I would like to try hypnosis.
Why is that?
Because I think there's some things that I probably don't remember. But, you know, I do. I would go back to therapy because I like talking to people,
mm-hmm.
and it doesn't hurt. It's absolutely not.
Yeah, it's always
harmful.
A good thing. But you're not. You know,
so it can only do good. Schedule is so crazy that I don't really have time for it. And also, I always had a bit of an issue with spending money because I grew up in such
poverty.
You know, financial constraints that it always felt odd to like do that. So, but I did it anyway because I felt like it was an investment in myself and
mm-hmm. it is.
And I felt like it was really necessary mm-hmm. to do that work.
What?
But, I don't have a burning desire to go back to therapy.
Yeah,
right
that's
now.
Cool.
But I have discovered this, group that, meets, but I've only gone a handful of times, to be honest. I don't make proper use of it. They talk about malignant narcissism.
Mm-hmm.
Have you heard of that?
I've heard the term.
Okay, well,
but what's the group about? Is it people who have it? People that have it. Yeah, would never be in the group.
So no, it's about people that have that in their lives.
Survivors of malignant.
And the other thing
it's
that
a survivors I, group, really, isn't it?
Yeah, and the other thing that I was really into for a couple of years.
Do you think your mother was a malignant narcissist?
Probably.
You have thought
probably.
That. But you thought that.
Yeah.
I'm not saying is she or isn't she. It's something you've thought about.
Right. I'm not qualified to make that diagnosis.
Me neither. But it's something you have thought about.
Right.
Okay.
The other thing that I thought that I've gone to over the years is Al-Anon, which is also a great tool.
That's really helpful. How is that helpful? I mean, you haven't had a drinking problem.
No, Al-Anon is not for the drinkers.
No, for the survivors of drinking, people with drinking problems.
Or substance abuse. Yeah, either one.
Mm-hmm, have you?
It's for people who are affiliated or have had that in their lives, whether it be parents, right, or relatives.
So have you had that, or is that?
I've had that, yeah.
So you've had people around you who have substance abuse problems.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's
not the greatest, but I think it is good. Like, I think it, all of those things, all those tools, like you, mm-hmm, one should make use of them, you know?
So we have like 5 minutes left. Let me ask you. So what, when you think about the things that you, don't remember that you would like to remember in hypnosis, what kind of things come up that you, what kind of holes?
I feel like, well, I've had some dreams that are reoccurring, and I would like to get to the bottom of them. But that's all I'll say about those, because mm-hmm, I feel like I'm not really prepared to discuss that publicly.
Are they childhood dreams?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I mean, dreams from childhood.
But, you know, one dream that I have had that's also reoccurring, mm-hmm, but is completely positive. So it's a mixed bag. I have like, mm-hmm, two different dreams. One is like very negative, and the other one is super positive. And the positive one, I'll talk about, because that's a nice, mm-hmm, thing. The positive one is I'm back in the house on 23rd Street at the old squat theater, and my dog is there, and the house is either.
How old are you about?
I don't know, because
like
I'm
seven,
just
nine.
Well,
something
it's
like
if you're
a child, pre-adolescent,
not necessarily.
Okay,
not necessarily. Mm-hmm. Sometimes I'm an adult and I'm like, oh, this theater, I mean, the building is still here and everything is great. Sometimes it's been abandoned. Sometimes it's like half, you know, kind of, mm-hmm, crumbling at some parts, mm-hmm, of it. But, you know, there's still people sometimes moving around in there. But it's really not for me. It's the connection to the building. Like I mentioned how beautiful it was, mm-hmm, and how good I felt in my room, mm-hmm, and the skylight and this, mm-hmm, large space. Mm-hmm. I had a very unique, I guess, mm-hmm, connection to the building itself. Mm-hmm. I felt safe there on, mm-hmm, many levels. And to me, the building itself recurs in my dreams in a very positive, mm-hmm, way. I'll have this dream maybe once every year and a half. It's not something that is very constant. It's not like I have this dream every month or anything. But when I do, it's always the same feeling.
That was your family, the building.
Yeah.
I
guess.
Yeah, maybe. One more question, and then we got to go, because this thing ends at 3. That's why. But you didn't have hot water, you said, when you were growing up. So did you have to take a cold bath?
We would warm up water on the stove and then bring it up a flight of stairs in pots and pans.
That's pretty freaky, no?
Yeah.
Or did it seem normal to you?
No, it wasn't normal. But I think at a certain point we did get heat back. I'm not.
And then what? You didn't have any heat? Were you?
We had kerosene heaters.
Did you sleep in winter coats? And that sounds horrible. No? Did you get sick?
Yeah, I was sick a lot. Yeah.
That's horrible, no?
Yeah.
There's a lot of real hardships that you don't talk about.
Well, for the theater, you make sacrifices for the theater.
Now see that sarcastic remark? There's more defense there. You've got too many defenses to get through in one session. Anyway, I just want to say thanks a lot for listening. Stick around. We got Ilan Danziger. Go to our website, Radio Free Brooklyn.